Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, a weekly series of podcasts about happiness and work culture.
Hi, this is Bruce Daisley. Thanks for listening. I said at the outset of these podcasts I was going to do between 5 and 1 million episodes, and this is episode 10, so that's good, isn't it? If you enjoy it today, please do share this episode. Whack it on your Facebook, tweet it, push it through a neighbour's letterbox, leave it as a passive-aggressive note for someone on their windscreen, gift it for the guy in the office who has BO. All sharing is appreciated. My fascination with work culture comes from the experience of living it and enjoying it. But increasingly, firms are using culture as a means of differentiating themselves. Often the outward projection of business cultures is an enigma or it's shrouded in misdirection. Tech companies seem to dominate our discussions on culture. Partly, a lot of businesses have arrived out of nowhere with the mystique of a new pop star. Part of the ways that businesses present their cultures is deliberately misleading. One of the oft-reported myths of culture is 20% time at Google. Have you heard of this? The idea that millennial audiences are so desperate for meaning, for purpose, that companies need to give them time to work on their own projects. 20% time is the example of this. You're allowed to spend 20% time working on whatever you want. Well, the interesting thing about this is that I worked at Google for 4 years and no one once mentioned 20% time to me. I was in a commercial role, so maybe it wasn't there. So I'd ask engineers, do you have 20% time? And they'd always laugh. They'd say, 20% time, yeah, that's called Saturday. There was a presentation doing the rounds last week by Ben Horowitz. I've tweeted it from our Twitter handle. Search for Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. He's your classic master of the universe. He's one of the founders of Andreessen Horowitz, a venture capital firm that were early on Facebook, Foursquare, Twitter. His presentation about culture majored on a few points. One of them was interesting. He said, to build culture, you need, in his words, to create shocking rules. His example of this was Facebook's famous move fast and break things rule. He said the discordant nature of these shocking rules made them appealing for people to work there. OMG, we break things here. It's worth saying, actually, as an aside, move fast and break things has been updated. And now, without exaggeration, it's now move fast with safe infrastructure. Doesn't quite have the same abandon to it, does it? It's like moving from, hey, let's go crazy, to let's go crazy, but also, can we keep the noise down? Actually, I've got work tomorrow. I might get the bill. Uber's got some of these shocking rules. For a starter, Uber has a series of 8 Uber competencies they expect all employees to possess. Vision, fierceness, super pumpness are amongst the list. Team members are rated on their super pumpness every year. Maybe worth asking yourself how super pumped you are today. Probably the closest Uber has to a Ben Horowitz-style shocking rule is always be hustling. A Guardian article last week said that there's an Uber-versity where new hires are schooled that getting a product to market ahead of the competition, even if it's not fully ready, is the Uber way. This is what always be hustling looks like. So how do these shocking rules explain a company's culture? Can news stories we've seen recently about Uber be explained by their culture and their attitudes? For this episode, there was only one person to ask. Brad Stone is a leading expert on US tech firms. Not only does he work at Bloomberg in San Francisco covering tech, but he's also written 2 must-read books on them. The Everything Story is an in-depth study of Jeff Bezos at Amazon. It explains an interesting culture that revels in keeping costs low. For a long time, every desk at Amazon was a cheap door mounted on legs. Every meeting reflecting Jeff's cerebral, introverted nature starts with everyone silently reading a document for 15 minutes. Brad's just published another work that's intriguing and timely. The Upstarts has him spending time with Travis Kalanick at Uber and Brian Chesky at Airbnb. The Upstarts documents how Uber and Airbnb navigated the challenges of creating startups that for a long time were they're on the wrong side of regulation. I went to the busy broadcast floor at Bloomsburg to ask Brad about the culture of these firms. And to start, Brad told me how Jeff Bezos set about creating the culture at Amazon.
He was extremely thoughtful about it, right? He wanted a high achievement culture. He looked to Microsoft across Lake Washington and thought, you know, we don't ever want to be a country club or rest on our laurels. And he set early in the company's history a set of values that he evolved over the years, but that attracted a certain kind of employee and probably ejected some people who weren't very well fitted. And one of the values, Amazon values, that stands out to me was there's one that is with regards to what he calls social cohesion. He thinks that people will try to get along with each other and that can obscure the search for kind of the truth. There's a value around kind of conflict yielding better outcomes. And so Amazon has become, you know, can be an environment where people kind of bang off each other as they argue for like the greater good. That's why Amazon can be a kind of uncomfortable place to work, but it, arguably one of the few companies that has managed to innovate at scale. You know, Uber and Airbnb are both, you know, in their first decade as companies, and I would say, you know, less just mature culturally. In fact, in the case of Uber, perhaps a little meandering in terms of, you know, what kind of workplace culture they have and that's sustainable. You know, both of these companies have had rapid growth, right? You know, from hundreds of people to Airbnb, probably between 3,000 and 4,000, and Uber over 10,000 in just 2 years. So I would say probably, you know, there's a little bit of chaos that reigns at both companies. So more so with Uber, which doesn't have the seasoned management team that I think Airbnb has right now.
And I guess, you know, specifically going into someone like Uber, we've seen Uber's been so much in the news lately and so many issues. But in fact, it's only by going through your book you're reminded there was the issues of 2014. There was the issues of, I mean, this sort of a laundry list of major PR disasters. Is there something in the culture that just create those things, or is it about the space that they're in?
I mean, I think that they, you know, they were not the first company to try to innovate in transportation. There was almost a battlefield full of bodies of companies that had sort of failed to make any headway in reforming the taxi industry and modernizing it. And it took a kind of a rogue company coming from outside the framework of the industry, you know, battling the local taxi commissioners in every city that were beholden to the taxi fleets, being stubborn and pugnacious. And that's Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber. Now, he's not a gentle guy. He can be combative. He likes to sort of hash things out by pacing around and talking in these all hour-long jam sessions. And that behavior, you know, yielded great success, but it yielded a lot of conflict. It yielded a kind of gunslinger mentality in a lot of places around the world that probably competitively benefited Uber, but left some conflict. And I think, you know, that's part. So the conflict and the PR disasters, as you say, is sort of part and parcel of its success. For example, as I write in the book, they like went international very quickly. They opened markets all around the world. They basically empowered their local general managers to be CEOs of their industry. And you needed that local decision making because every market was different and there were different enemies and, you know, in every city. And they would give everyone this loose set of instructions called the playbook, and people would run their businesses similarly. Well, that decentralization would cause problems. For example, they gave everyone a tool to monitor the usage of the app called God, and it was called God View, and that created a privacy problem when people found out about it. The local general managers and their teams were free to create their own marketing initiatives, and there was a team in France that decided that they would have a little bit of fun with talking about how you can like get paired with an attractive female driver, and that created a PR disaster. And you know, and so the lack of reins on these local offices would end up creating some problems. So the market may have required it. In fact, Lyft tried to expand in a much more centralized way and probably lost a little bit of strategic ground because they were trying to manage everything. They didn't want to make the investment in people on the ground. And ultimately, they had to kind of bow to the mechanics of the industry. So, you know, perhaps part and parcel with their approach, and maybe some unintended consequences as well.
Because you end up across I really enjoy Vipstarts, but across the Amazon book as well, you end up asking yourself, I ended up asking myself the question, does a company become its leader? Mm-hmm. And you can definitely see it in the Amazon case.
Yeah.
You know, meetings start with 30 minutes reading a document. It's quite thoughtful that everyone has this sort of emblematic desk made from a door to demonstrate that it's a frugal organization. The organization reflects the leader. Is that as fully the case when it comes to Uber or comes to Airbnb?
Yeah, I think it's probably different for every company. I think in these three cases, we're dealing with larger than life CEOs that probably do kind of project their personalities onto the organization. Certainly true with Amazon. Like I describe Amazon and the Everything Store as scaffolding built around Jeff Bezos' brain, and all of the mechanics and customs of that company are designed to take advantage of, to maximize Jeff's skills and his brilliance, and to take advantage of how he best processes information. Reading a six-page narrative at the start of every meeting is not how probably normal people would engage in a productive meeting, but it has emanated because, you know, it's how Jeff prefers to do things. You know, these two operating review sessions during the year that Amazon has, it's maximizing his influence so he can touch every part of the business at least twice a year. No one-on-one meetings with direct reports. Again, like putting a lot of people in the room with him as much as possible. It's certainly true in the case of Amazon that you have a larger-than-life personality who has guided the culture. And he has reinforced the values of that company over and over. The DoorDash, as you say, and to all his kind of communications with the company, reinforced the values of frugality and a customer-first mentality. Yeah, with Uber, it's the same way. Some of Travis's quirks, like the jam sessions and whatnot, stem from him, how he processes information. With Airbnb, it might be a little different because you have three strong founders and, you know, two of them are designers. I think that design sensibility infuses the company, but it comes from Brian and Joe Gebbia. You know, and frankly, like, you know, you've got a very strong CFO in Lawrence Tosi from the Blackstone Group, who I think has brought a little bit of professionalism to that organization, almost like Anthony Noto at the Twitter, you know, kind of a Wall Street mentality to get what was probably a kind of freewheeling, maybe sort of like whimsical culture where, you know, they would celebrate the birthdays of the dogs, you know, that they brought to work. And he's matured and professionalized the organization.
And one of the things that I wondered whether through all of these stories, we'd seen sort of the growing up of the internet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to some extent, some of the stuff that you talk about, the opportunity that's presented by technology is this wide-eyed and wondrous thing. It's all opportunity. And then what we find later on is that things go wrong. So Airbnb, you highlight a couple of examples where Airbnb didn't anticipate PR disasters. Someone's home gets trashed. Another person dies of carbon monoxide poisoning. Someone else illustrates that actually Airbnb is reinforcing, the hosts are reinforcing some of the racial issues that maybe had existed previously. And it was sort of like, as the internet was growing up, that optimism was running aground. Is there a degree of truth in that?
The first couple of generations of internet companies could exist in isolation, right? They impacted the world, but you know, they didn't have to deal with lobbyists or politicians in some cases for decades, you know, after they were founded. And so, you know, these companies obviously encountered the real world and the messiness of it very early on. I think they're both marketplace businesses. And, you know, if you look at eBay, you know, marketplace business, once you get that flywheel going, it's enormously powerful. When I think back, you know, eBay is like the canonical marketplace. And, you know, and I think back, you know, they started to run into problems with their suppliers, the unhappiness of their suppliers. But that was like 10 good years into it. And again, you know, online marketplaces were new. There wasn't a lot of like built up knowledge about their mechanics. You know, now everyone's a lot savvier about it. And I feel like, you know, the drivers on Uber, the hosts on Airbnb, they've been a lot more vocal much earlier on about, you know, kind of their rights and pushing back at the company. Airbnb has done a much better job in cultivating their hosts and creating a community. You just need to get into the back of an Uber to know that, you know, the driver has very strong opinions and it's in some cases like feels like an indentured servant. So I don't know. The age of these companies being able to sort of stay within the confines of Silicon Valley and ignore the kind of tumult that they're kind of, you know, creating around the world are over. Like, these companies had to engage very early on, not only in the political process, but in, like, they had to deal with the consequences of what, you know, of the economic changes that they were creating in their industries.
You talk about something which is Travis's rule, which is basically, I mean, is it worth you describing that?
Yeah.
And I wonder what impact Travis's rule has on how the company then ends up behaving and the culture it creates.
Yeah. So Travis's law, as I define it in the book, is, I'll try to recite it from memory. It's any service, any company or that's offering a service that's markedly better than the status quo. In a place where the politicians or the lawmakers are reasonably accountable to the people, if the people love that service, they will kind of turn out to support it, and the politicians will have no choice but to basically legalize it. And so the idea is, if you're a sort of sympathetic upstart and people love your service, as ambiguous as the law is, you know, you can get a change and have a good outcome. And I think that was the playbook in the early years of Uber. The difference is that they are the status quo now. You know, the Travis's law worked in the early years when they were posing as a fresh alternative to a kind of regulation encrusted taxi industry. I mean, here in London, you know, you had black cabs, you had mini cabs. You could hail one, you could prearrange another. The black cabs fought credit cards for years, and when they had them, they wrapped them up in tape because they didn't want to pay the fees, right? I remember that. And so they weren't very accountable to the people, and they fought any initiative to put more cards on the street because they didn't want the competition. So, you know, Uber came along, presented, you know, an economic option for people, and maybe the only option in neighborhoods that weren't well served by one of the other categories. And people voted, you know, with their tweets, you know, or with their emails and said, we want this in our city. You know, Uber rode that wave of kind of populist support. The difference now is it's like a $70 billion company. We think when we, you know, nobody remembers that only 5 years ago, their taxi options were limited. It's like, you know, Uber is the status quo, and it's not that sympathetic anymore.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Uber is the status quo now, and it's seen as sort of a heavyweight, and, you know, and it's not presenting an alternative anymore. It is a primary option in a lot of cities. So,
and the guest question I had was, did Travis's law and the fact that it seemed to be enacted and true for so long, did it create this bravado culture?
Oh,
that
interesting.
Effectively, you know, the bombast came from. Every time we tried something, every time we pushed at a door and we pushed hard enough, the door opened. And so did that create sort of a cultural bombast, a self-belief that maybe
I think it reinforced maybe the natural arrogance of the CEO and the company that they were, you know, that they were
delivering kind of, you know, they were on God's mission, you know, to reform the taxi industry. And, you know, when you look at some of the kind of scandals that have erupted around like a tool called Grayball, right, that they were, you know, purposely like avoiding the taxi commissioners and their inspectors in every city, you know, that came from a belief that like, you know, that these guys were, you know, they believed that these guys were backwards looking and protecting an incumbent industry and weren't out for the best interests of customers. You know, that, that may have been true. That was true in a lot of cities. And I think it helped that, like, you know, that they were always secure in the fact that, you know, if push came to shove, they could get a couple of thousand, you know, customers to go and bury, you know, the city council people with emails and support. So yeah, I think it added to their arrogance.
I saw something this morning, which was a report which was basically saying that recruiters increasingly are looking at organizations like Uber and asking candidates how their cultures reflect on the candidate. And it was just an interesting thing because you effectively end up then with, rather than these places being destination employers, that maybe
like high turnover places,
or just, you know, I think the thing I read today was that the value always be hustling might be seen as really appealing internally, but externally people are worried about what that, what the baggage that candidate comes with.
I see. So, like, they might be more reticent to hire somebody from Uber.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. You know, and it's funny because I've heard that occasionally with regards to Amazon, that the experience can be so impactful that some companies might shy away. Where the culture of a company could like affect a person. So, yeah, always be hustling, or this idea that like conflict will yield the best outcome. Yeah, I can see how that might, you know, that might have an impact on someone in a culture that is really oriented more towards collaboration and consensus seeking. You know, that kind of person might not fit in.
Is that one of the values? Conflict will lead to the best outcome.
I think yeah, we could pull up Uber's values. It's in the book, and I think it's similar to one of those ones at Amazon where, you know, where like this idea, and I know that Jeff Bezos believe pretty strongly in this, that like people naturally seek a consensus. It's just like a human orientation, and that can be destructive if what you're doing is trying to find a kind of ferret out a sort of unpopular truth.
And just, I guess, final question really, it appears in these organizations that their outward embodiment is very much a reflection of their culture, or it seems that culture and the brand become so amorphous to an extent. And I just wonder how true you think that is. Can you have a very different brand externally to your culture internally? Or where do you see that as being the case, and where do you see that not being the case? I guess Amazon less so, right?
I think they're part and parcel the same thing. I mean, Amazon's culture reinforces a customer first mentality, right? Like frugality is all about like devoting your resources, saving your money to pass along to customers in the form of lower prices and better deals.
The things we've observed about Uber, so the things we've said, conflict produces better outcomes, always be hustling, produces this urgent bombast, this machismo, which actually now we're seeing reflected in the brand, right? You know, people are seeing, I met a nonprofit yesterday and I was talking to them and I said, you know, would you ever partner with the likes of Uber? And she said, we'd never touch Uber because the way the brand's perceived. So, you know, this, I don't want to use the word toxicity, but, you know, the sort of the negative perceptions of that aggression, of that bombast, end up being reflected. And I just wonder if, you know, those things that you tolerate internally, so the things we're seeing about, the things they tolerated internally, are now actually being manifested as their brand.
Okay, so I have a couple of thoughts. When you look at all the first generation internet companies, you know, Amazon is the only one that continues to innovate at scale. Like, there's a definitely a natural tendency of any company toward inertia, right? It's probably human nature. It probably has to do with when an equity kind of slows down and the kind of people you attract, or just the expectations of the public market. And so I think a certain kind of like relentlessness, you know, it turns out to be a good thing. We've seen that with Amazon. It alone, among that first generation internet companies, kind of continues to grow and innovate at scale. Then you go to Uber, a newer company like Uber, in that recent recent video of Travis in the back of an Uber talking to two friends, and then he gets into an argument with the driver. Some of the listeners probably saw that video. He says at the beginning of that video, one of his friends says, "I hear you guys are having a hard year." And he says, "I try to make every year a hard year." And it's revealing. Like, I think he has intuited the lesson of Amazon, which is you want to make people a little bit uncomfortable, right? You want to light a fire under your people, otherwise you're going to be kind of sliding toward inertia. You know, the question is, when you're moving so fast and you haven't like set up the proper guardrails of like a professional human resources organization, which has obviously been a problem at Uber, you have these like terrible anecdotes, like the sexual harassment allegations, and it begins to impact your brand. You know, do you start kind of scaring your not only your employees but the outside world? And so, you know, you're kind of caught between two ends of the spectrum. One, not wanting to slow down. You know, Uber's still a private company. It can't slow down. It's got existential dilemmas in the form of like driverless cars and competition all around the world. But at the same time, you know, you end up like breaking so many eggs that, you know, you ruin the meal. And so there has to be a medium, and I'm not sure Uber has found that yet. And I think the lessons of these PR disasters is that perhaps they've been moving a little too quickly or fighting inertia a little too hard with some negative results.
Fascinating. Thank you, Brad. Thank you for joining me. I'm super pumped you made it to the end. Next week, we've got something amazing that combines work culture, One Direction, and technology. I honestly can't wait. Always keen to hear your views. Do me a tweet.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.